This broadcast of Irish Radio Hour from Glucksman Ireland House, NYU, is paid for by Glucksman Ireland House, NYU, in association with Flannelly Promotions Limited. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to This Irish American Life, coming to you on WNYE 91.5 FM in the tri-state area. I'm Dr. Miriam Nyhan Gray, and I am your host on Saturdays from 9 a.m. to 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. Glucksman Ireland House is New York University's Centre for the Study of Ireland and the Irish Diaspora. It was founded in 1993 by Loretta Brennan Glucksman and her late husband, Lewis L. Glucksman. We teach, research, archive, provide public programs, and generally educate our community on the Irish experience at home and abroad. We come to you every week from our home on Fifth Avenue in New York City's Greenwich Village.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and I'm so thrilled on this week's This Irish American Life to sit down with playwright, musician, all-around great person, Larry Kerwin, and we're going to talk about his musical going up on Broadway, Paradise Square. Enjoy this interview, folks. It's fascinating.
I'm thrilled to have somebody with me who's an iconic figure in Irish New York and Irish America more generally. And the excuse I have to talk to the great Larry Kerwin today is I can't say new musical because it's not brand new, but it's going up again, as one would say. And I believe, Larry, I'm speaking to you in Chicago, where you're in rehearsals for a Chicago run of Paradise Square, which is the excuse, as I say, I have today to snag you for this chat. First of all, thank you for taking the time out to chat to me today. And can I congratulate you for being at this point in the process with Paradise Square? And can you tell us a little bit, for those who don't know, about the history? I know bits of it, Larry, but I'm not sure even I know all of it. Can you tell us the context in which we're having this conversation today? You're in Chicago and it's coming to New York in the spring, from what I can gather.
Yeah, I'm in Chicago, and after 10 years of this, I'm still alive. So that's the big news. Getting something to Broadway is a huge task. This began as an idea, probably began with my grandfather, who raised me back in Ireland. He was from Carlow originally. I'm from Wexford. He moved to Wexford. But he'd had a best friend called Ned Cudahy in Carlow. And when they were 10, both of them, Ned went off to America. And despite the promises of both of them, Ned never wrote back. And even as an old man, this irked my grandfather. Certain, there was a sadness to it, but he would always forgive Ned, and he would say, "Ah, poor Ned, he probably got lost in the Five Points."
Yeah.
And that was my first memory of hearing about the Five Points area of Lower Manhattan. And so I always kept my ears open for it, but it wasn't much known in Ireland at that point. But when I got to New York as an immigrant myself, I ended up on the Lower East Side, on Avenue B, and found out that I was only walking distance to the Five Points. So I used to walk down there and try, and when I got to America, I read a lot about the Points, and I would try to visualize the life that was down there, although much of it had been, built over by the court system, Foley Square in that area. And then one day, I was in, I think it was the Strand bookstore. I spent a lot of time in secondhand bookstores in the 70s and 80s, and especially on Saturdays and Sunday afternoons, I came upon a book that was a history of Lower New York. And lo and behold, there were pictures of etchings that had been done in the African American dance halls in the Five Points. And these were a revelation to me. First of all, because I was a musician, this is before Black 47, but I was really interested in how the musics of the world combine. And the first thing I looked for, of course, is the bands. And they were always mixed race, usually an Irish fiddle player, an Irish singer, African-American banjo player, an African-American percussionist. And I used to look at these guys and try to figure out, how did I know what to play? And I figured it was that the fiddle player was probably playing the Irish jigs and reels, and that the African-American musicians were improvising with them. And there were also pictures of the dancers. One in particular caught my eye. It was dancers doing a set, you know, with their hands up like that, a row of them. And I was stunned because it was always a black man and an Irish woman. And it was the look of joy on their faces and the delight in each other. I knew these were romances that the artist was trying to convey. And from that, I thought, these people were married eventually. And what happened to their children? And I began to read about it, and lo and behold again, I found out about amalgamationism in the Five Points, that it had always gone on there, black people and white people getting into relationships and some marrying. But between the beginning of on Goethe Moor and 1845 and 1863, with the huge influx of Native Irish coming in, there was a real surge in it. And these people were hated by the uptown Protestants, as they call them, the establishment, because a lot of people forget now that there was such anti-Catholicism in the U.S. at that point. But, and the uptown Protestants weren't that keen on black people either. But now they're going to have the double threat of brown Catholics. And you could feel in the literature of the time that it was a resentment against them. And then I read about the draft riots and how on July 13th, 1863, that world died because the African-American dance halls were closed. And the good times, as they were, and the Five Points ended. The Five Points continued for quite some years, but the spark had gone out of it, and it just reverted to being a slum. It wasn't a place that people visited anymore. So being a playwright and a musician, particularly a playwright, I could see the value in something like that, that it could all be a play about this this phenomenon of the Irish and the African American. It could all be boiled down to one night, July 13th, 1863, because for drama, it's always good to have a, you know, a time element, the characters working against time. And over a period of time, I began to develop the characters, particularly the woman who was at the center of it. Her name at that point was Nellie Blythe. She's now Nellie Friedman. And that came from hanging out in the after-hours scene of New York in the 70s. There was a huge scene. I mean, we didn't go out till midnight in those days, and you went to a bar first, and then around 3 o'clock, you start to move towards your favorite after hours. And mine tended to be around Lower Manhattan with a couple up in Harlem. And quite often these after hours are run by black women. And these are pretty tough places. Thinking back on it, I begin to wonder, well, what was I doing there? Even, you know, but when you're younger, you're just totally fearless. And I always wondered about them. How are they able to hold it together? And I really admire them, particularly one up in Harlem. Her name is Rose. And she was this very skinny woman, African-American, and she was just so welcoming to everyone. And yet, she was like steel inside, and if anything happened, and with a lot of illegal stuff going on, but it had to be at her level, you know, the way she wanted it. And so I based Nellie not on her, but on the idea of a black woman being able to control rowdy white men and black men in those times, the way I had seen it happening. In the 70s in New York, there was a certain lack of law and order and everything. So she couldn't call the cops because it was illegal what she was doing, and yet she was able to maintain order. So I based the play on her. And then, of course, I knew anyway that Stephen Foster had been down in that area, but I never kind of associated him with the Five Points. I had read a classic comic about him in Ireland when I was a kid, and of him dying on the Bowery, which he didn't do. He was close to the Bowery, all right, but so I placed him there too. And I went back into his life and his songs. You know, I knew about five or six of his songs. The songs had been really popular in Ireland, and I'd played them in bars in Wexford, and the dockers in Wexford used to sing them. They loved them. And I was thinking, this guy was just universally popular. And then I began to look into all his other work and found other songs I'd never heard of, like his songs like No One to Love and Welcome Home, Willie. And I began to form other characters and around those songs. And I began to reimagine Foster's songs. First of all, the way you hear Foster's songs now, they're like parlor versions, very sedate on the piano, and people almost giving recitals of them, because that's the way they were sung in people's houses when they started to get pianos at first. But I wanted to see, what do these songs sound like if the black and white band that I'd seen in the etchings, if they were playing his songs, what would they be like? And it would be a lot more rocky and rolly and juba-y and whatever. So I took them back to that stage and then moved them forward again into more musical theater. And that became Hard Times. It ran a couple of times with great success in the Cell Theater on 23rd Street. And a gentleman called Peter LeDon came in one night and saw it. We were pretty close to closing. Everybody loved it, but it wasn't going to go anywhere after this. I was with Black 47 at the time, so I was thinking, on to the next project. But he was floored by it, and he called an associate of his in Toronto named Gart Trubinsky, who was a famous producer. And he loved it, and he invited me up there, and we talked about it for a long time. And he told me he could see it being part of his trilogy of Showboat and Ragtime. He had produced both of these, and I was thinking, are you serious? Hard Times is going to be for like Showboat or Ragtime? And it was hard for me to understand. He said, yeah, just trust me. And So we got working on it. There was no other offers. Well, yeah, so I was up there quite a bit for about 6 months, and then we knocked it into a certain shape. And then he said, now we'll bring in other people. And he brought in Bill T. Jones, the choreographer, who I adored. I couldn't believe I was actually going to be working with him. I used to go see him a lot. My wife is a dancer. And Moises Kaufman, the director, and Craig Lucas, the playwright, and, you know, Jason Howland, the musical director. So we all got together and we came up with Paradise Square. That took a long time. That took from 2014 to today. There were a lot of workshops up in Toronto. He would bring up all these actors and musicians and dancers from New York and combine them with the ones he knew in Toronto. It was exhilarating. But the show was always controversial because it was dealing with race and it was dealing with the Irish meeting African Americans, and then it ends. Because it always stunned me how far apart Irish and African Americans were in New York. Because I grew up in Ireland, and, you know, we adored black music. You know, we adored James Brown and all the greats, Four Tops, all the same, the Temptations. So I guess in a certain way, when I came to New York, I thought that people would be more together because Irish people love black music. But it wasn't that way at all. And I always just wonder why. And then as I began to work on Hard Times and then Paradise Square, I realized that there was a huge break on July 13th, 1863. People went back to their own. And neither side really wanted to deal with the fact that they had been close at one point. You know, there was a lot of hurt. 11 African Americans were lynched during the riots, and a lot of them left the city. And the amalgamationists and their children, many of them left the city too. And because the children were brown, they were subsumed into African American culture and lives. So there's always been that thing with this musical. Each time we get a new cast in, or we do new drafts of it, or come back, it arises again. History begins to relive itself within the production. And then everybody gets that out of their system, and then it's a great experience. But history and race always come back.
So that's really fascinating, Larry. And I'm so personally fascinated just because I'm animated by similar questions to you, although I pursue them in a different way through academic stuff. Thank you for sharing all that context and everything. So if I'm like, for people who say aren't familiar with you, your thinking behind this, so the origins, like there are things coming to mind in terms of your preconceptions of like African American culture and Irish culture from Ireland as a child, as a, you know, young person, and then your encounters as you recount Rose as the example. But for people who don't know you, or, you know, your trajectory in between all that, you're like, you know, heading up like probably the most famous rock band in that circuit of Black 47. Can you tell me a little bit about the history of Black 47 as it kind of it crosses over that the gestation of everything behind what becomes Paradise Square?
Yeah. Well,
did you come to New York to was that what you've set out to do by coming here? You know what I mean, in terms of Black 47 and everything.
I came for adventure, first of all. You know, I'd seen Midnight Cowboy, and I was thinking, wow, this looks like a good place. So, I came with my guitar. I knew how to play, and I knew I could make money enough to live. And I didn't want to have a steady job. That was one thing. I wanted to explore life, and I thought it was a good idea just to take what I had. I think I had about $150 or something like that. And I came to New York and had a lot of adventures in between these events. And then I was with, I went back to Ireland and I came back with a guy called Pierce Turner. Mm-hmm. We were childhood friends and we were called Turner and Kerwin of Wexford. And we used to play for Malachy McCourt, of all people, at the Bells of Hell. We were the house band there. And but we were also, because you could make good money up in the Bronx around Fordham Road and Kingsbridge at that time in the Irish bars. So we were very different than the music up there. We played kind of an experimental music, but we also knew how to play rock and roll and whatever, Irish music. So we were able to survive and people liked us up there too. And then we became a punk new wave band called Major Thinkers. And we had a success with a song called Avenue B is the Place to Be. We got signed up to CBS Records, Epic Records, which is a big thing at the time. We couldn't believe it ourselves. And we were friends with Cyndi Lauper. She was starting out at that point, and we were on the road with her for quite a while. And then we got dropped, as happens in the music scene. And I just didn't want to go back into music. I'd always loved writing, and I wanted to give it a shot as a playwright. So I chucked in music totally and became a playwright. And for that was from 85 to 89. And I did nothing except write, direct, and produce the plays. And with the first play I had, Liverpool Fantasy, if the Beatles hadn't made it, it became a success. But we weren't able to keep it going because we didn't have enough money to do it, even though it went from a small contract to an off-Broadway contract and was selling out. And then that play started to get done in Ireland and England and around the country. And so I was kind of off as a playwright. And for the next 3 or 4 years, I wrote, I think it was 4 plays and put them on. But then I began to miss the music because I found that I was getting really introverted. All I wanted to do was sit at a desk and have the characters roaming around in my mind. And one night I was doing that. I was writing a play called Blood, which is about James Connolly, how James Connolly got kidnapped right before the uprising, in a little known fact, by the IRB, the Revolutionary Brotherhood. And I thought to myself, I think I'm having a breakdown. I thought, I better go to a bar. I got to hear some Irish voices because I was pretty isolated on the Lower East Side and in Soho at that point. And I decided I would walk up to Eamon Durant's from Soho. That was a hell of a walk. But I thought it would clear my head. And as I was passing a place on 28th Street and 2nd Avenue, I heard music, and it sounded good. And I looked in, and there was a band playing there called Beyond the Pale, and the place was really full, and the leader of the band, Chris Byrne, recognized me from the Major Thinkers, and he said, "We have a celebrity here, and we're going to get him up to sing." And I was thinking, no, I'm freaking out. The last thing I want to do is be up on a stage in front of people right now. And the son of a bar said, no. And Chris is a very persuasive guy, and he said, yes. And the bartender, a woman called Dimpna, Dimpna McDonald from Monaghan, I didn't know her at the time. She said, "I know what you need." And she came over with a big glass of whiskey and she said, "Drink that." I guess she was used to looking at people and could see that I was having troubles at this point. So I drank the whiskey and then she said, "Now get up on stage." It's not like an Irish woman ordering me around. Your mother's voice comes back. And I got up.
Ask my husband, Larry. Ask my husband.
Yeah, exactly. I knew exactly what I was supposed to do then. I got up on stage and I had the greatest time. I haven't played really in 4 years and anything conventional. I was playing improv music. And it was a great night. And at the end of the night, I'm sitting at the bar with Chris and Dimpna is still giving us whiskey. And I could tell he wasn't in good form. I said, "What's the matter?" And he said, "Well, Beyond the Pale are breaking up tonight. I have all these gigs up in the Bronx and in Queens. And I'm going to have to not do them. And I need the money. You know, I've got a young family." He was a cop at the time, by the way, too. So I said, "I'll do him with it." And she said, "Really?" I said, "Yeah." And he said, "What should we call ourselves?" I said, "Only one name," because I remember my grandfather used to say it with a real reverence, but also kind of a fear or it was an odd way he used to say it. I said, "Black 47. His father had escaped the famine. So people of that age, when they said the words Black 47, was just a little bit of awe almost, but fear and loathing. And so at that point, we made the decision we would form the band and we would just go from straight away to original music. Beyond the Pale had been, you know, a band that were really good, but they basically weren't doing very many of their own songs. But I had come from, doing all original songs. But we just had, the following Friday was the next gig. And so I went home and we wrote down lists of, songs we could do that both of us knew that we could jam to. And I looked up all the original songs I had and wrote those down and made a cassette for Chris, who was a great ilum pipe player. And we headed off to the Bronx to do 4 45-minute sets. I think we had 2 rehearsals and we figured, well, no one's going to be there between the first and the fourth set. So we'll repeat the first set for the fourth one, so we just needed 3 sets at this point. But they hated us up there. Oh man, they hated Black 47 because we were rowdy and loud. I was playing electric guitar and programming a drum machine, and I come from the CBGBs kind of scene, so I was used to confrontation. But confrontation in the Bronx—they're pretty tough people up there at that point. And Chris was a New York City cop, and he was a great ilum pipe player, barong player, and tin whistle player. And he was also a rapper from Brooklyn rapper. So it was an unusual band, but there was a boom. Actually, it was a depression, but there had been a boom. This is late 1989. There had been a boom to the late 80s. And there's 2 things Irish immigrants want to do: either buy a bar or own a racehorse. In those days, immigrants are different now. So there's a lot of new bars up around Bainbridge and 204th. So when we get fired from the first bar, we just go to the next one. And they all, The great thing about the Bronx is they all wanted live music. Even if they didn't like it, they wanted live music to be in the bar. So we were the only new band around in those days, and then we started to get better, you know. And we played Queens and Brooklyn, and we were doing some gigs in Manhattan, and then Dimna from and Steve Duggan, the manager of Patty Riley's, asked us to come in and do a residency at Patty Riley's, where we had met. And Patty Riley's was doing pretty bad at the time. I later on got in trouble because I said even the cockroaches were leaving. So what happened was, the great thing about Manhattan, so if you had 20 people like you in the Bronx, 20 in Brooklyn, 20 in Queens, they'll all come to Manhattan. They wouldn't dream of going to their own, to someone else's borough. Mm-hmm. And so right from the start, we were drawing crowds in Riley's. And then word got out that there was this band that were playing original music, and we used to play there on Wednesdays and Saturdays, and the place was jammed, and there would be lines around the block. This is without pretty much any outside publicity except for the Voice and the Echo, who were both great to us right from the start. And the Irish People was going at that point, too. We knew the editors of that really well, because we were pretty political at the time. And record companies started showing up, and all sorts of celebrities, every actor, every celebrity, and Joe Strummer in particular from The Clash became a big fan and associate of the band. And it was just a great scene in the early 90s in New York City. The city wasn't doing well, and you had this relief. You had Black 47 to go see, where it was totally a wild scene in there, and you never knew who you were going to meet. And then we began to play around the country. Steve Duggan started to book us in Irish festivals, which weren't the big thing they are now. They were basically kind of old men's festivals, you know, that bring their families to it. But a guy called Frank Bradley in Chicago, where I am now, took a liking to us, and he started to book us at his big festival in Gaelic Park. And then what happened was Black 47 started to attract a lot of people who would normally go to an Irish festival. So Irish festivals started to boom, and they started to get better PA systems and whatever. And the Northern Crisis was still going on at that point, and we were vocal about that. So we were bringing politics and wild music and a pretty defined political point of view, both ideologically and about civil rights in the north of Ireland. So it was a great time. And then we got a big record deal. Did two albums for EMI, and then did another album for Mercury Records. So then we were on MTV, and we were on Leno, Letterman, O'Brien, all those shows, and we became what Black 47 became.
Yeah, because Larry, you know, I remember, you know, I came after all that and whatever, and I, you know, kind of in my time, even though I'm, you know, over a decade now plus in New York, but I remember when Black 47 was disbanding, when you finally called a day on it, it was remarkable to me just how, you know, impactful that was in terms of, like, there was, you know, devastation that you guys were going away. But what strikes me in what you're describing is, you had a very, you had a bird's eye view of, like, Irish America as it was in that period. And in that period, to come back to the kind of race theme, Larry, how are your, you know, you've kind of described, you know, your preconceived, you know, warmth towards African-American music in particular coming out of Ireland, which I think, you know, I noticed that too in terms of a positive affinity with Irish people from Ireland generally towards African-American culture. And then how you see that kind of distance when you arrive in the United States and you come to understand that based on the historical context. But how are your ideas about what Irish America means and how that intersects with Black American culture, especially in a sphere in which I believe you were not only comfortable but embracing of mixed identities in terms of, I think I've heard you describing the makeup of your band at times, sometimes being all white, sometimes having Black members of the band, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, you made an offhand comment there recently about how traveling as a band that had Black members was different to traveling as an all-white band. Can I provoke you to comment on any of that stuff?
Oh, yeah. One thing I would say is, and I'm not saying this in any boasting sense, I probably knew Irish America better than most people because I took a real interest in it. And we played every state on the mainland of the USA. And so I got to know people in each place. And it always fascinated me that all these people came from Ireland, or their people did, and yet the environment of the city molded the Irish in that city. And so someone from Boston is very different than someone from Chicago, and very different from someone in San Francisco. You know, but even within that, in small towns, you could see the difference. And you know, when you're traveling a lot, you can either party the whole time or you can have an interest in something. And because I was the front figure, and Black 47 shows were pretty exhausting. Well, not exhausting, but you really had to be sharp the whole time because you're dealing with an audience that was moving because there was a lot of action and jumping up and down, and you know, we were doing political songs, so you had to segue from a song, say, about James Connolly into a song about Maria's wedding, and you know, they're very different styles of music and everything. So it behooved me to both ride on the road and to also to be looking forward to going someplace, even though it was a hole in the wall, to find out, you know, the history of the place and the history of the Irish in that place. So I got to see a lot of Irish America and to, you know, to ponder on it. It was just great. Like, another person who does that is Martino Muller from the Irish Echo, and I read a column for him in the Irish Echo. He's very much that way too. He's kind of fascinated with Irish America, this great big slumbering beast that we were able to get moving in the 90s, you know, get them really interested in Irish politics, in particular what was going on in the north of Ireland. What I found out in relation to Irish America and African Americans was that the split was just so intense and extreme that had happened, I think, back in 1863, that the peoples didn't know each other anymore. The African Americans, when they would think in terms of Irish, would think, Irish cop, he's going to kick my ass. You know, I got to keep away from him and be careful. You know, And the Irish were thinking, Black man, he's going to rob me, you know. So that you had to get past that. And one of the ways Black 47 was able to get past it was because we were dealing with a lot of different styles of music, and in particular, funk and reggae. You know, we enjoyed those themselves. So even if we were doing, say, a set of reels, we would set them to a funky beat or something like that. Or even if you're doing a song about James Connolly with a hip-hop beat behind it. And that was able to draw people in. And as you say, we had a black bass player, Kevin Jenkins, for quite a while, which is amazing. And he taught us so much. And you know, there was a high level of musicianship in Black 47. Guys came from different styles and disciplines. You know, like Fred Parcells was kind of a Latin jazz kind of a guy. And Jeffrey Blythe was from Dexys Midnight Runners. He was very much soul. And Thomas Hamlin was into African-style drumming. So the roots of their love for music came from black culture. So when we had Kevin in the band, Black 47 was so popular in Irish-American areas, it was like, oh, we got a black guy in the band. That's cool. And then they were able to meet him. But even more important than Kevin, our road manager, and he's the guy who runs the show on the road, was a black guy called Nico Wormworth. And Nico is very effusive with people, and everyone loved him. He's a character. And they got to know him, and that would thaw out the whole atmosphere around the relationships. So all these little things built up, and I could see that black people and white people, or African American and Irish, had these bonds of love of music, love of talking, love of partying, love of family, and sentimentality, you know.
And what you say, though, Larry, is so, you know, it's so basic in a way, in terms of like proximity and getting to know each other, because of the, you know, how you describe the kind of corners into which the communities had retreated for different reasons.
Yeah.
You know, in part, I think because for the Irish, they also realized it was politically and socially and culturally expedient for them to distance themselves from, you know, to move up the hierarchy in terms of, you know, distancing themselves from the group that was, you know, the out group, so to speak. But to come back, I wanted you to fill in Black 47 in terms of context for people who were not familiar with that background. But I want to come back to Paradise Square with you, Larry. So, mm-hmm. So tell us, you've alluded to it, but tell us what Paradise Square centers on, right? It's one night, it's that night, July 13th, 1863. Can you tell us just a little bit about it? Not a spoil. We don't want spoilers, but, you know.
Well, the action is set mostly in Nellie's bar, and she's been married for some time to an Irish immigrant called Willie O'Brien. He and the bar, because they're amalgamationists, they tend to attract people who are okay with that, and to attract other amalgamationist couples. And it's not just a bar, it's a dance hall. So there's dancing going on pretty much all the time in the background. And the Civil War happens, and Willie goes off to fight, as did many Irish men of the time, and he gets killed. And now it's Nellie on her own, and can she hold on to this bar and hold on to the feeling of the bar where amalgamationism is accepted as even cool, and despite the outside forces that are closing in. In a certain way, it's like America is catching up with amalgamationism. Because it's in this very poor, deprived area, nobody really cares about it. But with people turning against Lincoln at the time, so the action happens a few days after the Battle of Gettysburg, and it centers on, can Nellie save her bar in the midst of all the conflagration that's going on in New York? So many buildings are burning and whatever, so many people are getting killed in the riots. And that's the story, with a lot of music and a lot of dancing.
So in some of the promo footage around Paradise Square, Larry, I've been struck by, and you probably encounter this, and I encounter this in general, a lot of black people and a lot of Irish people, particularly Irish people in Ireland, but also even in the United States, don't know that history, you know, which is remarkable to me given how impactful that era is and the events around the draft riots and everything like that. And I saw in some of the promos, even I think it may have been the lady, the actor playing Nellie, I can't remember, saying, you know, I didn't know this history. Is that something that you've encountered as well?
Nobody knows it, you know, or very few know it. And I think that both sides, when they retreated to their own people, didn't want to talk about it for many years, you know. They both felt it was demeaning or whatever, the unions. But you know, the history of poor people is not really well documented because nobody cared about them. You know, if you think of history, you think in terms of great men and the occasional great woman. Although there were a lot of great women, but they didn't get their due, as they say. So who cared about these people? You know, their own friends probably didn't, or their own relatives, many of them didn't understand. The way I look at it is that when the Irish came here after or during on Gertrude Moore, social order had broken down in Ireland. And one thing that I didn't realize until much later was that more women emigrated in that time than men. And these young women who arrived in Lower Manhattan, for the first time they were on their own and they could do whatever they wanted. And there was a great dance scene going on, and young Irish women, at least when I was growing up in Wexford, they all wanted to dance, you know, and go to dances. That was how you met people. So they started to attend the best dances, and the best dances were in the African-American halls. They met young, attractive black men who were great dancers, who probably drank less than the Irish guys who were coming over, you know, and not understanding New York or the culture, kind of retreated to the shebeens and the Irish bars, whereas the African American guys were, you know, they were used to New York and they fell in love, and that was it. And that was the culture, and that was how amalgamationism was born. And then after 1863, there were no dance halls anymore in the points, and those encounters stopped. And the Irish women of that period went back to being what they would have been in Ireland, you know, pretty conservative, with the church taking over, taking control of them again. So there was that period of 18 years when Irish women were unmoored I would say, and were able to do not just on Moore, but they were able to do exactly what they wanted to do for the first time, or to follow their own notions and not have to go to a relative's house for entertainment. No, they were going to the dance hall and having a great time. And that's what led me back to that etching that I saw of the dancers, black men, Irish women, and I could tell that this is what the artist was trying to put across, that these people were in love with each other. So it was a very human story, and that's what I wanted to tell, and that's I think what people like about the show, put aside all the politics, because it's political, but it's about people. That was one of the things that I took from Black 47. We were a very political band, probably one of the most, but at the same time, we never said, this is what you have to do, which is usually the way political music is kind of shouted at you, you know, rise up or whatever, you know. Our way of doing it was of telling the story of someone and then letting people get their own picture from it. You know, don't do what I say was my point of view. Here's the story. Take that and let it sit in your head. Now you do whatever you want to do. And I think that led to a great opening. I think, say, with songs like Danny Boy, which is about a gay Irish construction worker, it opened up a lot of people in New York City, a lot of young Irish people, to the fact that gay people are okay. You know, Black 47 like them. All right by me, yeah. So,
Larry,
as simple as that.
Yeah, no, that's wonderful. You're being incredibly generous with your time, and I know I need to wrap up with you soon because I don't want you to be late for rehearsals. but just before we finish, I just want to, if I can ask you, when you describe the chronology of Paradise Square and everything, its gestation and from hard times, et cetera, et cetera, it's like things take off again in 2014, and the United States are around that, right? The United States and the world is in a very different place to today in terms of the weight of race. You know, I feel like, you know, I don't know whether you would agree with me, but that was a time when I don't think it's like exaggerating to say there was more optimism, you know, not to overstate the significance of the election of Barack Obama, but that there had been this monumental event in American history in terms of his election. And things have changed. I don't think anyone could foresee just how much these things could change for me as a historian in a relatively short period of time. Can you reflect on that a little bit? And in terms of if that, or I imagine it has impacted the gestation of the musical. What are your thoughts on that?
No, it hasn't affected it because we haven't allowed it to. But in America, race is always there. And it's on a fulcrum. And sometimes it slips to the left with Barack Obama, and sometimes it slips to the right with Donald Trump. So I don't see it in the awful way that a lot of people see events of today. Because you take the amalgamationists, this climate today had nothing on the Civil War in 1863, and yet amalgamationism was able to flourish until, as I said before, America caught up with it. So I'm an optimist on history, and you know, I do see how, and I study history and politics really closely, I see how Obama's era just went like that and Trump's came in. But you know, that's always been happening. There's always been that shift between left to right in American life and in the life of Europe too. You know? So we haven't allowed this to stop us in any way. But you do have to deal with the sensitivities of actors towards it. It brings up there are 38 different actors in this piece, and they're split equally, 50-50, black and white. And I can see the fulcrum in there shifting even day by day. You can feel it as someone begins to think of something they have to say, and it opens up a history inside them of both themselves and their family. And you know, I feel for them, because a lot of people are for the first time confronting. I mean, a lot of the actors for the first time are really having to confront feelings about race with their fellow actors. And one thing that struck me about them is, and it's great for the future of America, I think, that they're all able to deal with this, and their other actor friends gather around them and help them through it. And it's just heartwarming to see it. So we're getting through this day by day, and America will come through the ups and downs of the Trump-Obama fulcrum and continue to evolve. You know, times might seem bad, but if you think back, they're better now in lots of ways than they were. You're allowed to think. You know, Irish America used to be so uptight like that, because it was the 50s generation, people coming over from Ireland in the 50s. And, you know, Ireland was an awful place in the 50s. And they come here and they're trying to hold on to that and trying to establish their own communities, and everything is a threat. That's not the way with Irish America now. It's open. You even go into a sports bar on a Sunday afternoon, and there's all these Irish Americans cheering for their African American players on their teams. You know, they don't even think of that anymore. They're just invested. They're used to black and white. And I think we're going to go into a better age. And I'm hoping that Parada Square will enable people to come and see this story and see that if that could happen at the height of the Civil War, right after the Battle of Gettysburg, it can happen again.
We're coming towards the end of the program. I'm Dr. Miriam Nighan Gray, and I'd like to thank you for listening to This Irish American Life, coming to you on WNYE 91.5 FM in the tri-state area, and worldwide on www.nyuirish.net/radiohour. If you'd like to hear this program again, please go to our website at www.nyuirish.net/radiohour. Thanks for tuning in, folks. Have a lovely weekend. Remember that next week we will be back, same time, same place. We are always very happy to have you here on This Irish American Life. And thank you for being with us for another week. Slán agus beannacht. Our theme music today is the opening set by The Gloaming, produced by Brassland and Real World Records. And this broadcast of Irish Radio Hour from Luxman Ireland House, NYU, was paid for by Luxman Ireland House, NYU, in association with Flannelly Promotions Limited.